I'm here with Chris Abert with the Indiana Recovery Alliance, right?
It's correct.
The whole state Recovery Alliance. Okay. And could you tell me a little bit about Ian Stark and kind of the beginning of what is now the Indiana Recovery Alliance?
Sure. So, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, a young man named Ian Stark was found deceased in a stairwell. He had died from exposure. And a few friends and I thought that that was tragic, right, to say the least. And rather than just complain about it, we wanted to start to form relationships with people more that were on the streets. So we started doing outreach. We got bikes, bike trailers, blankets, coats, things like that, first aid supplies, camping supplies, and just started hitting the streets, giving out those supplies.
Where did you get that, those supplies, the blankets and everything? Well,
people's garages, people's closets.
Just spare ones that you had laying around?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what does that look like now? So that was a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So now what does the IRA look like now?
So out of that, we started hearing from people that they needed clean injection supplies, that they needed a myriad of other things, that there are huge gaps in services. So we started exploring different ways to deliver those goods. In the midst of all that, there was a largest HIV outbreak in the history of the country, about an hour south of us in Scott County. Approximately 5% of a town down there lives with HIV now, primarily from IV drug use. So that changed the laws in the state pretty quickly in a reactionary way to be able to deliver these preventative services. So we jumped on board that. A few of us moved away from the other project and incorporated a nonprofit to be able to start to do full harm reduction, but still do exactly what we were doing before. So we still have bikes, we still have trailers, we still have, you know, these really close personal relationships with people who are experiencing homelessness and poverty.
And how many members have you grown to?
Members as far as volunteers, we have approximately 10 to 15 that put in time every week. Hundreds more that do community syringe pickup, going around trying to find syringes if they've been improperly disposed of. And as far as participants, we're about 1,600 participants for the region. Primarily, the vast majority of those are Monroe County.
So is that also Bedford and Ellettsville, or is it primarily focused in Bloomington, or do you get into the rural community at all, I guess?
Sure. So we don't do direct outreach in the rural community. It's difficult to figure out where you would go. But definitely people come in from rural areas. We do outreach in Bedford once a week. We do outreach at Shalom twice a week. We have office hours, and then, of course, we have our bike outreach.
And can you talk a little bit, one of the biggest things it sounds like that you do is harm reduction. And what does that mean, harm reduction?
I think the easiest way to say it is that harm reduction is just looking realistically at the world and saying there are certain things that have always existed and that will always exist. For example, people have had difficulties with alcohol since we first started squishing grapes. Right? So the idea then isn't to necessarily, you know, we want to curtail people living in chaotic drug use, right? We want to help them no longer live in chaotic drug use, but we also want to keep people alive. And one of the things that we've discovered is that if you collaborate with people by meeting them exactly where they are, and you ask them honestly what positive change looks like for them, that they'll tell you if you have a good relationship with them. So we try to find out what that looks like. So does that mean positive change is using clean syringes as opposed to sharing syringes? Does it mean positive change means moving away from a drug that's causing a lot of difficulties in your life to a drug that isn't causing as many difficulties? Does positive change mean abstinence, long-term abstinence? Does positive change? So it's all these things. So the short of it is that harm reduction is any positive change. And we know that the cumulative effects of these small positive changes within the population lead to tangible and large effects in our community, as a whole. So this is good for the individual. It's good for the community. I think what I like about it most, too, is it connects people, despite the fact that they are continuing to engage in activities that tends to have them pushed to the margins of society, so we can keep people connected.
So it sounds like you allow whomever it is that you're serving, be it a user or someone who's experiencing homelessness, you're kind of letting them create what harm they want to reduce, right?
Yeah.
You're letting them define where they need services.
Absolutely. So what we want to do is we want to build honest relationships where people can actually tell us what they're experiencing in their lives. A good parallel is domestic violence, right? So oftentimes people will just continue to tell someone who is in a situation of domestic violence, you have to leave, you can't be there. Well, there are myriad reasons why a person can't leave. So then to just calm down on the prescriptive you have to, and open up a conversation about, okay, so you're in this difficult situation. What can we do now to keep you as safe as possible? And it takes a long time of, treating somebody with respect and dignity to be able to have those type honest conversations where they feel comfortable enough to be vulnerable about what's really going on in their lives. And I don't think you can be helpful to really collaborative with a person at all if you have no idea what's actually going on in their lives, right?
So it's not like a holistic prescriptive approach. It's very much dependent on their willingness to engage.
It's absolutely driven by their willingness to engage.
And
one of the nice things about it is I've been a social worker for 14 years, and this is the only non-coercive, truly collaborative work I've ever done. So there's nothing over anybody's head. Nobody's going to lose their kids. Nobody's going to go to jail or have their probation revoked. It really is 100% participant driven.
Does that get frustrating sometimes when you see somebody who had been making progress either backslide or change their goals or not want to work?
Honestly, when somebody, quote unquote, backslides, because I don't know, but when somebody has a setback from a goal that they had set for themselves and comes in, it's actually says everything. It says that we've done our job building good relationships where people feel comfortable enough to come in those circumstances. Because typically there's a lot of shame and guilt. So if we can build relationships where people show back up, they get a much different reaction from us because we're really happy to see them in that exact situation. Does that make sense?
It does. You would be happier to see them coming to you from a position of vulnerability than you would be to see them, I guess, just be better all of a sudden, I guess.
I would rather have a honest relationship with them where we could meet each other exactly where we were so that they didn't have to feel like they couldn't come in because they didn't meet my goal, right? So we're really clear with people that if they come in, whatever their goal is, that's their goal. And if their goal changes, we want to see them just as much as if they meet the goal as presently stated.
And so you said that there's currently a lot of stigma, and I know that there's a certain legal issues as well. I think it's a felony to possess a syringe. What is the current state for somebody out there who's experiencing addiction or homelessness? And has that changed since you've first started, since Ian Stark? How much has that changed? And are we going forwards or are we going backwards?
I think in the broadest sense, but also very in a small but broad sense, the narrative is changing in general. The fact that we can even offer these services. But this stigma is over 100 years in the making. It's steeped in anti-immigrant sentiment, in racism, in institutions designed to control certain populations. So it's not going to just go away. But I absolutely think that there's progress being made on it. The felony issue is very difficult. because the state has two opposing currents happening right now. One is they sanction giving out syringes, and the other is they will then put you in prison for having that syringe. We know that the number one cause reported for improper disposal of syringes is fear of arrest. So we think it's really unfortunate that local police continue to arrest participants and charge them for possession of a syringe. Hopefully, with proper training and conversations and understanding of data and research, everyone will understand that continuing to arrest for something like possession of syringe, it's not effective in cutting down drug use by any measure. It's detrimental to our community. It leads to more improperly disposed syringes. But more importantly, I think for police, it doesn't allow for some of the benefits of syringe access, one of which is a 66% decrease in accidental needle sticks to police officers. Right. So we can get in and train police officers and say, this program is actually very beneficial to you. A, you don't have to arrest as many people, right? And do all the paperwork. So, B, you won't get stuck by needles nearly as often.
So arresting someone with a syringe increases the likelihood that an officer will be accidentally stuck with a syringe.
A person having to hide that syringe and not declaring it, right, increases the likelihood. So we know from research, I'm not just making these things up, but we actually have research to back this up, that accidental needle sticks drop over 60%, 66% if there's decriminalization laws.
And has there been any communication with Bloomington police departments or surrounding areas?
Sure. Yeah, we've offered that training. We've sat down through numerous meetings. We continue to offer those trainings. We reached out to the sheriff's department, and within a couple days, Sheriff Swain got back and said that he would be happy to have us come in and do those trainings. We haven't quite got to Ellettsville yet, and there's nothing we can do about the state police, and they almost arrested me. So
let's also talk about, you had brought up Sheriff Swain's office recently. He made an announcement and then retracted that announcement that naloxone kits would be reserved for public safety officers because of a limited supply. Could you talk about the supply chain of naloxone, or Narcan, it's sometimes called, and where do you get naloxone as a nonprofit, and how is that process distributed or sanctioned, I guess?
Sure. Well, the specific naloxone that went to law enforcement recently came from the previous attorney general's office. He had used settlement money to purchase naloxone and then train people, typically first responders, to administer it. The reason there was no more naloxone to give him is because we have a new attorney general, Curtis Hill, and Curtis Hill's agenda seems to be to continue the drug war. He has said things such as, we can't fool ourselves and try to save drug addicts. He's been incredibly vocal and active against harm reduction efforts and for increases in penalties. Again, it's unfortunate because the data is in that the war on drugs didn't work, right? And we need to stop criminalizing this, stop treating it like a moral issue, and understand this is a public health issue and a human rights issue. We offered naloxone to the sheriff's department. The mode of administration we uses rather large syringes, and I don't think that there was a lot of comfort with using those. So it ended up that the health department was able to give them the naloxone that they needed.
And that was nasally administered naloxone, which I understand is different than the syringe administered.
Yeah, so we use the syringe administered because it's considerably cheaper than the nasal. So the nasal can be up to $140, whereas the syringe-based is about $10 to $15. Now, what the audience should know is that we're in this opioid crisis because of pharmaceutical companies and because of deceptive practices through the 90s with palliative care type opiates suddenly being prescribed outside of palliative care, right?
What is palliative care?
Like hospice care, end-of-life care, helping people die with dignity and without great pain. So we're in this because of that. And then on the tail end of it, in the last 5 years, these naloxone prices have gone up extravagantly. So what used to cost a dollar now costs 15. What used to cost $350 are now $4,800 for auto injectors, like EpiPens that talk to you with naloxone in them. So it's a shame.
Is that simply because of demand, or?
It's simply because they can make a profit off of it.
And so what does the situation look like for South Central Indiana currently?
It's not just Southern Indiana. This is a nationwide epidemic. I think people forget that when they think about, oh, what's going on in Kirkwood? It's not Kirkwood. You know, it's Rhode Island. It's Portland. It's Iowa City. The whole nation is in the grip of opioid crisis. 91 people have fatal overdoses every single day. And the time this interview will be over, if it takes about 20 minutes, a person will have passed away. Hepatitis C is the number one infectious killer in the country. The problem is only going to get worse. Experts say, I don't mean to be alarmist by any means, but experts say probably by 2021, about 500,000 people will have died from this epidemic. So I think it's important to realize that programs like ours and more programs that will come are not causing this to happen. We're coming in mid-game. We're coming in the middle of it, and we're trying our best. But the problem is actually probably going to get worse before it gets better. Now, without naloxone distribution and clean syringes being available, the hepatitis C rates and overdose rates would have been even more tragic and numerous than they have been. So we've given out probably 6,000 doses of naloxone, and we've had about 700 overdose reversals reported to us in the last 18, 19 months.
And what do you think needs to happen in order to, if not stop entirely, mitigate that 500,000 deaths?
Sure. So there are lower estimates, not much lower, but there are some lower estimates. There's such a extensive list of things that need to happen, including systemic change. I don't think we can bring that about nearly fast enough, if ever. But clearly, giving an antidote out to something that's killing people is a pretty sane and reasonable solution. The other is to make sure that people don't catch infectious diseases that they could easily avoid, given clean syringes and other equipment. Increased treatment, and increased treatment of outside of people's comfort zones, right? So methadone, buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone, other medically assisted treatments, and move forward into prescription heroin, safe injection sites. If we want a clean Kirkwood without so many overdoses and people using drugs openly and erratic behaviors, one of the ways you can do that is you give people a place to be while they're going through a difficult situation, right? That could be a safe injection site. That could be crisis mental health care. That could be expansion of services such as at Shalom. But people need a place to exist, right? Unfortunately, especially with Kirkwood, people are forced to live their lives in the public eye. So these things are happening on way more than just Kirkwood. It's just that that's a much more visible point.
And you had, of course, mentioned the fact that this is not just an Indiana problem, this is a national problem. But when you guys bike around and hand down blankets or take out the truck and set up a needle exchange, what does the situation look like to you? And do you feel like it's getting better, or are you seeing more people, or what does it look like out there?
So as we're able to build rapport, more people will come in. It's a rough guess. I would say maybe we're about halfway through Monroe County's actual IV drug user population. So we want to make sure that we get more people in. We want to make sure also that when people come in that actually desperately do want help, that they can get it, right? It's alarming how little opportunities there are for treatment of any kind. I see people that are confused. I see people that are suffering, and then on top of confusion and suffering, there's this villainization and this stigmatization and this hatred. I don't know of many other groups presently where people will publicly say, with their names attached to it, just let them die. They deserve to die. They've made this choice. You know, we had a similar attitude back in the 80s with the onset of the AIDS epidemic. And there have been other populations historically who've been treated like this. But it's sad. So it's always good when we're able, again, to meet one-on-one with someone when they come into that office and give them a smile. And we've heard before from people when they come in that this is the first smile they got all week.
What is the counter argument of that? Not to be crass, but why not just let these people die? Obviously, that's horrific.
It's absolutely horrific. I'll answer it anyway, though. Yeah. But so it's hard to even answer it. So yeah, if you say didn't have a conscience at all, and you had completely dehumanized people who were absolutely human and suffering, right? In many cases, the argument could be made that two arguments. One, you hear all the time people say, well, this is our tax money. We shouldn't be spending our tax money on it. Well, if you really don't want to spend tax money on people and the drugs they use, we should stop the drug war, right? You want to talk about tax money being spent. There's literally billions of dollars that have been spent. So you're right. Let's stop just spending any tax money on drug users. On both sides. On the flip side of that, you know, recently in Morgan County, the coroner had to go back to the commissioners and ask for more money because the amount of people that had fatal overdoses in Morgan County had surpassed anything that they could have expected. So those I just don't even like to talk about it like this, but those it ends up being billions of dollars in lost money. And as I said, I just want to end with this on that. It's disgusting to have to even talk about it like that. But the truth of the matter is because it's affecting white suburban and rural populations, and because of the economic cost, we are having a shift in certain leadership's views on it. Right. So one of the most devastated parts of the country, of which we're a part honorarily, not in a good way this way, but Appalachia, right, extends into southern Indiana. But a lot of the senators and congressmen in that area had a sudden flip, you know, when it's their area that has these really difficult hepatitis C rates, right, when it's their neighbor's kid who had a fatal overdose, when it's their constituents, you know, who are suffering the most. So I think the important thing to remember out of that is if, as we make progress on this, and we will, right, even if it gets worse before it gets better, but as we make progress on this, that the traditionally marginalized populations who have been left behind or who have been specifically, you know, prosecuted, right, under drug laws and other social institutions, that we not leave them behind again. Is that right? So we're making progress. We're destigmatizing a bit. We're treating it more humanely and compassionately. And let's make sure, again, that if it returns to being an African-American or a Latino problem, that we continue, right, to reach out to people in a humane and compassionate way.
So there are certainly a lot of detractors about not just your program, but any kind of form of harm reduction. And it kind of sounds like, at least in your opinion, we're seeing that with A.G. Hill. Is there anybody that you work with across the state or across the county? Who are some of the benefactors or some of the people that you see either also engaging in harm reduction or at least working towards a humanization of addiction?
I mean, honestly, so there are people in the higher-ups that are friendly, and that move forward legislation. But really, the truth of the matter is all of this comes typically from grassroots organizations, right? So the reason we can distribute naloxone is because another group did it illegally for nearly a decade. because it was the right thing to do. The reason we can distribute syringes is because other groups went out and risked that felony, giving them out without state sanctioning. While I'm happy that some of the leaders are, I air quoted, leaders are helping, the truth of it's just a grassroots push. Nobody is going to care more about people who use drugs than people who use drugs and their friends and family. And historically, it's been those folks and a few other allies that have really made the difference. It was people who injected drugs who turned the tide on the AIDS epidemic in specifically in the injection drug user community, right? Not in the gay male community, but in the injection drug community, and it'll probably continue to be that way. So our allies are people who use drugs, their families, their friends, and those that love them exactly as they are.
And a certain naloxone is an anti-opioid. Recently, we've seen a lot of overdoses, or at least it's become more public because it's more apparent on Kirkwood. We saw scores of overdoses of people over one weekend with spice. You don't do anything with spice use, or do you?
Sure. So we have, it's hard to do any research on. Everything we do is research-based. So really quickly, I'll say to detractors, bring the data, right? Because luckily we have 30 years of data on our side. The thing about spice is that there's not a lot of research. One of the defining factors of spice is that as legislators move to make it illegal, the manufacturers will change a certain chemical. So you never really know what you're getting, right? So we don't have a lot of research on that. We have a lot of interview type research that's happened with active drug users about their experiences. And we started to gather that to try to help keep people safe who are using spice, right? So we can say, hey, well, this is working for people if they, you know, have a friend there, or use just the smallest amount first, or just move away from spice and maybe towards marijuana. It seems like if something as simple as the legalization of marijuana were to happen, that our spice epidemic would drastically end, right? People wouldn't need imitations, because that's all it is. It's supposed to be an imitation of marijuana. The benefits of it are, for people using it, are that it typically doesn't come up on drug screens. So again, all this harm is intertwined with our criminalization of drug use. And we know that if you move away from criminalization and take the money that you save and put it into social services and programs that connect people back, that drug use decreases, right? Even though it's not illegal anymore and no one's threatening you, it just on its own decreases. So an instance of that is the entire country of Portugal. So Portugal decriminalized in the early, mid-ish 2000s. And the results have been phenomenal. They went from some of the highest overdose rates in Europe to some of the lowest, what they call reactivation of people. Out of chaotic drug use and back into their communities. But they did that by investing in it, right? So it wasn't just stop criminalizing. It was also take that money and say that somebody's using drugs and they're a mechanic. Well, then you take the money you saved and you pay half of their salary at the local garage for the first 2 years, right, to get them reintegrated. That you, in Iceland, starting up programs for youth, the surest way to keep youth out of not even experimenting with drugs, but problematic drug use, right? So the way to keep them out of problematic drug use is to give them engaging, inviting, exciting activities to participate in. And they're doing that in Iceland, right? They're doing that in Portugal. They're moving forward all the time throughout the rest of the Western world. While it's in part invigorating, it's also demoralizing and deflating to think about how barbaric we are here.
Is there anything that I haven't asked or anything you feel like our listeners should know?
I mean, I would just say, you know, nice people take drugs, right? Let's remember that. I think people would be shocked by who walks through that door to get syringes, right? By the wide variety and the, you know, different temperaments and humors and talents, right? And difficulties, and stories, and oftentimes, you know, what they're doing on their way to, you know, they're getting their syringes right before they, you know, stop down and pick up a skateboard for their kid before they go to, you know, Boy Scouts, right? And so we need to, like, reframe the way we think about people who use drugs.
Chris Abert, thank you very much for speaking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.